ARE Study Guide Podcast.
Hello, my fellow study companions. How are you doing today? Today we are going to talk about something really, really important. This is the AIA document B101, Standard Form of Agreement Between Owner and Architect. As aspiring architects, this is a document we need to know well. Just for some context, I took my exam, was it a week ago? Let me double check that real quick, because that's insane. Wow. Okay, yeah, so like, today's Saturday. Last Saturday, I took my exam. I can't believe it's only been a week. It feels like a lifetime ago. But wow, here we are a week later. I just passed my construction and evaluation exam. So one of the biggest things for this exam, if not the biggest thing, is knowing these AIA documents, the A101, the A201, and the B101. So, you know, being the good little studier I am, I really studied these documents for a few days before my exam. You know, I really crammed them. And took my exam, passed, and, you know, I have all these random facts about the relationship between the owner, contractor, and architect floating in my head. You know, so the year right now, I mean, if you just saw that I just released this episode, you know that the year is 2021. But if it's a few years later, you might not realize that we're, you know, just coming out of the pandemic right now. And so my work situation has been a little spotty. I've been doing mostly contract work, which has been fun. It's been a neat experience, you know, just doing random consulting and random things that people need that are architecture related. And anyways, so I was talking to a developer. He's a friend, but he's also hiring me to do some random things for him, you know, just small project management stuff. And he was telling me that his architect was asking him for more money. The architect made all these mistakes on the drawings and then submitted those drawings to the building department. And then, of course, all the plan check comments came back saying, fix these mistakes. It's normal to get plan check comments back. And I'm not thinking there's anything wrong with the architect for having made those mistakes. That's totally normal. However, the architect asked for $20,000 to fix like 15 really small errors that are all the architect's fault. And some of them, well, not just some, I would say half of them are just the architect used their standard details, like they didn't even review them. And they were referencing the old code year. So instead of saying the 2019 California building code, they all referenced the 2016 California building code. And again, like, these are normal things. I don't think there's anything bad about the fact that the architect did this, but I think there's a huge problem that the architect's asking for more money. And so I was like, well, I've just read all these contract documents. I don't think that's right. I'm pretty sure this falls on them because one of the requirements of the architect that we're going to learn about today, the architect is responsible for knowing the building code and doing a drawing set that is in compliance with the building code. That's one of our first and foremost responsibilities. Yeah, so basically this contractor had me go and review his contract to see whose scope this falls in. And if the architect was allowed to consider it an additional service to pick up the mistakes that they made. And my opinion is that no, they are not allowed to do that. And I don't know. I don't know anything about this architect, so I can't say that it's like bad of them. They might actually not even know the terms of their own contract. You know, they were using this AIA document, B101, and maybe they might not know this document that well. So I don't know the whole thing. I just know these documents are really important and really practical. And when it comes to issues, I think it's going to best serve us to really know what these documents say so that we can just avoid conflict in real life, or maybe not avoid, like reduce it. And if we can just reference in the contract, well, the contract says this falls on you or it falls on me. I mean, just think about all the headaches that we can reduce, because in real life, before I knew these contracts, I just see a lot of problems. I see a lot of conflicts about the owner, architect, and contractor in terms of who's paying for what. And when things go wrong, people asking for more money or the owner refusing to pay because of delays. And I love that it's all in these documents. So now that I feel equipped and empowered with this knowledge, I hope that I can help future employers and my own practice going forward to really like just reduce conflict and just say, well, this is what the document says. And, you know, then we can go from there if they want to keep, you know, fighting it out. But I think these are really important. Sorry, that's so long-winded. But there's a lot of value in this. Don't see this as just preparing for a test, because honestly, I used the skills from this test like yesterday. So in less than a week of taking the test, I used the skills I learned by studying for it. So these contracts are really important. Let's dive into them. Here we go. In the first section of the B101, again, B101 is the owner-architect agreement. The first section is initial information. In this section, it says that if you don't know something yet, because maybe it's too early in the project, because the owner and architect are probably signing the agreement pretty early on, whereas like for most types of project delivery methods, the contractor is signing up with the owner way later so that the scope is actually defined. But when the owner is signing this agreement with the architect, there could be a lot of unknowns. So you're allowed to write unknown at time of execution in that section. And then you and the owner can go figure it out later after the scope of the project's more defined. So this first section talks about the initial information, which includes the building's program, the physical properties of the site, a breakdown of the budget, key milestone dates, including the dates and deadlines for the different design phases, the construction start, and the date of substantial completion, the procurement method for the project delivery method, any sustainability goals and objectives, the name and contact information for the owner's representative, a list of people that need to review the submittals on behalf of the owner, any consultants and contractors that the owner is going to hire. This will typically, at a minimum, include a geotechnical and civil engineer, the architect's representative and their contact information, and any architect's consultants, so the structural, mechanical, electrical. Real quick, let's talk about the basic services for the architect. So the architect's basic services include the structural, mechanical, electrical, and plumbing. Anything else is considered a supplemental service. The owner is going to typically be responsible for the geotechnical and civil engineering, anything for the site development, not the landscape architecture, but the site development. That's going to fall on the owner, unless the owner wants the architect to do it, and then they can add that as a supplemental service in this contract. Section 2, the architect's responsibilities. The architect is responsible for being licensed in the jurisdiction where the project is built. If they are not, they are allowed to hire an architect that is. So let's say I'm working to become licensed in California. And because I didn't go to an accredited school, my license is probably only going to ever be for California, because a lot of states require you to go to an accredited school. Thankfully, California doesn't. So like, let's say, I think in Florida, you need an accredited school. So like, let's say I want to do a project in Florida, which is where I'm from. Well, I technically can't. If I wanted to do that, if an owner wanted to hire me, I would need to hire an architect in Florida to be my architect of record. I can't stamp drawings for a jurisdiction where I'm not licensed. This section 2 also talks about the standard of care. This is a huge, very important concept. I'm going to quote it directly from the contract. The architect shall perform its services consistent with the professional skill and care ordinarily provided by architects practicing in the same or similar locality under the same or similar circumstances. The architect shall perform its services as expeditiously as is consistent with such professional skill and care and the orderly progress of the project. So what this in a nutshell says, in so many words, is that an architect is not required to be perfect. They're not expected to be perfect. You're only expected to do as well as other architects do in your area. And you can't drag your feet and take too long to do the work. That's really important. So there's a lot that goes into our contract documents. We are going to make mistakes. We are going to have errors and omissions. And we are responsible for those. But when it comes to mistakes that we make, that we did to the best, like we designed something to the best of our ability, but the mistake was kind of beyond our breadth of knowledge. If other architects wouldn't have done any better, like the average architect, obviously there's like, you know, super geniuses in their own league of professionalism. But most architects, like we're competent. I'm not saying we're not competent, but you know, like there'll just be things we don't know and we do something wrong and it's not necessarily okay, but it's excusable. Like we're not perfect. We're not architecture gods. We're people. So yeah, standard of care. So we are only held to the standard of other architects in our area. You know, in California, I don't think we get tornadoes. I've never heard of a tornado being here. So I'm not going to think about making a tornado safe building. And then a tornado whips through and my building is like torn to shreds. Someone can't say like, you should have designed this to be tornado safe. It's like, well, no, like me and my fellow architects in the Bay, we don't design like that. That's fine. That's fair. Okay. Sorry to I'm dragging my feet. See, part of the standard of care is you're not supposed to drag your feet. You're supposed to do things in a timely manner. Sorry. Let's move forward. Also, within the architect's responsibilities, the architect shouldn't do anything that compromises their professional judgment. So if the contractor says, hey, I'll give you $1,000 not to tell the owner about this, that's compromising your professional judgment. You should not do that. The same goes with kickbacks. I assume this would qualify in this section. If a furniture company tells you, oh, I'll give you 10% of the sale, but choose my products. You shouldn't choose those products if they're not best for the owner. So you shouldn't take that money because that's going to compromise your professional judgment. The architect is responsible for having general liability insurance, car insurance to cover their travel to and from job sites, because if they get into an accident and they say, oh, I was going to your job site, Mr. Owner, you're liable. Say, no, you have automotive insurance to cover that. And then umbrella insurance, which the owner can request if they want an additional amount on top of the standard policy amount that you have. So say you have like, I don't know actually anything about insurance because I've never had it for professional practice, but let's say you have general liability insurance for $100,000, but the owner says you need to have it for $1,000,000. So you can get umbrella insurance to cover that difference of $900,000. The architect is also responsible for workers' compensation, employers' liability, and professional liability. And our professional liability insurance is that insurance which is going to protect us from our errors and omissions in our construction document set. So let's say you make a mistake in your drawing and it unfortunately has like a really catastrophic effect, like the balcony of your building falls off and you go back to your drawings and you messed up on your detail. That cost can be covered by your professional liability insurance. Section 3, the scope of the architect's basic services. So again, the basic services are structural, mechanical, and electrical. It doesn't say plumbing, so I assume that they consider plumbing mechanical I don't know, but they don't say it, but obviously we have to have plumbing in our buildings, and that's a basic service. But the contract specifically says structural, mechanical, and electrical. Anything else is considered a supplemental service. When the owner makes a change to the project scope, that's considered an additional service. So a supplemental service is a type of service, such as landscape architecture. The owner saying they want to add an extra bathroom is an additional service. The architect is not responsible for the work of consultants hired by the owner. It's all about who is the contract between. So if the owner hires a consultant, the owner is responsible for that consultant. However, if the architect looks at one of the owner's consultant's drawings and notices that there's any mistakes, the architect must tell the owner about the mistake. They can't just withhold the information. This is always true. If one party notices a mistake, they are responsible for telling the other party about the mistake. No one's responsible for double-checking anyone's work, right? We're competent people. We're supposed to be double-checking our own work. But if anyone notices a mistake, they need to tell the people that we have to fix mistakes. We're not allowed to keep these things silent and then have, you know, a disaster because someone was like, oh, well, it's not my job to check your work. I mean, I noticed it, but like, it wasn't my job to notice it. No, if you notice it, you have to tell someone. Part of the architect's basic services is providing a schedule of their work. So this is important for a few reasons. So first off, the owner needs to understand how long the architect's work is going to take, so that they understand how long the overall project's going to take, because the project, unless it's fast-tracked, can't begin until the architect's done with their work. Secondly, after each phase, the architect is going to submit their drawings to the owner for approval, and the owner needs to know that they're going to receive these drawings by a certain date, and then they have a certain number of days to review those drawings. Because what if there was no schedule and the architect sends the owner something, but the owner is in Cabo that week, or like for 2 weeks, like, or for a month, you know, off the grid, going on a trip, and the owner didn't know they were going to be receiving those drawings, or didn't plan for it, even if the architect told them like a week before, but if they didn't plan for it, and he's like, there's no way I can review it, and then the whole project gets delayed. Yeah, not cool. So the architect is responsible for providing a schedule of when each phase is going to be completed and then giving the owner a review period of adequate time. So this section, the basic services, talks about what the architect's responsibilities are for each phase. So during schematic design, the architect needs to look at the laws, building codes, reviewing the owner's budget, and coming up with like a preliminary design of the scale and layout of the building. This could be just a site plan, floor plans, sections, elevations. The architect needs to identify the major building systems that are going to be used, basic sustainability considerations, the building orientation related to the sun, the materials for sustainability, sustainable systems. And then the architect will develop a preliminary schematic design cost estimate. And then after the owner receives that drawing set and approves it, the architect will move into design development. And then this is when the architect is going to dive deeper and then design the major building details, decide on the major building materials, and update the cost estimate. And if there's any change from schematic design, they need to tell the owner about it. And then after the owner approves the design development set, the architect moves on to construction documents. And this is when the architect is going to develop the drawings and specifications that describe in detail the performance and quality levels of the building elements. After the architect develops the construction documents, the contractor will provide submittals that are going to really get into the refined details for the shop drawings on the material samples and the technical product data. The construction documents just describe the performance and quality level of the elements, the actual like really nitty gritty details for each little thing, that will happen in the form of submittals when the contractor finds things that meet the requirements of the construction documents. And then after the owner approves the construction document set, the architect will help the owner with procurement. So the owner and the architect will work together to develop a list of prospective contractors that they want to invite to bid the project. Unless it's a public project or they otherwise want to put a bid advertisement out and just notify every contractor who can see it, and the contractors can determine if they're eligible and if they want to bid it. And then after the procurement, we move into construction. So some notes about the architect's responsibilities during construction. The architect is not responsible for the contractor's means and methods or job site safety. The architect is responsible for their own errors and omissions. The architect's construction administration services end when the final certificate for payment is issued. The architect is responsible for visiting the site enough to be generally familiar with the progress of the construction. The architect is responsible for keeping the owner informed about the progress of construction and notifying them if they notice any defective work or deviations from the construction documents or project schedule. The architect has the authority to reject non-conforming work. The architect has the authority to request that work be tested or inspected. The owner and contractor can ask the architect for more information through RFIs. When decisions need to be made, the architect is responsible for making decisions that are the best for the project without showing favoritism to either the owner or contractor. They need to make the best decision possible. During the construction process, the architect is going to be responsible for helping the contractor get paid. So what happens is the contractor submits a certificate for payment to the architect. The architect reviews the request and verifies that the contractor has completed the work they're saying they completed. The architect isn't responsible for ever confirming the contractor's means and methods. They're not responsible for doing a thorough review or inspection of the project. It's just to the best of the architect's knowledge, they believe that the contractor has completed the portion of work that they're saying they have. Another topic that, again, was covered in a previous episode, but we're just going to talk about it a little bit here, is submittals. So in the beginning of a project, the contractor is going to develop a schedule of submittals based on the contract documents. So they review the drawings and the specs, and they see where submittals are required by the architect, and they develop a schedule of when the architect can expect to receive the submittals, and then there will be a timeline for how long the architect has to review the submittals. When an architect reviews the submittals, they are only reviewing the submittal to verify that the submittal meets the architect's design intent. Architects do not verify the accuracy of dimensions or the quantities. Architects are not responsible for verifying any calculations that are done by others. So if it's a shop drawing for, I don't know, like a steel bench or something, and you know the fabricators have determined the load capacity of the bench, the architect doesn't need to verify those calculations. That's the job of the fabricator. They're just looking to make sure that that bench matches the design intent. If the architect goes to the project and wants something changed, that's a small change that wouldn't affect the cost or project schedule, the architect is allowed to request the contractor to make that change. All right, so definitely review this contract yourself, because here in the section it's going to talk about substantial and final completion. We talked about that in this episode on project closeout, so review that, read the document. We're going to move on right now to section 4, supplemental and additional services. So again, the basic services are structural, mechanical, and electrical. Supplemental services are things that the owner pays extra for. They include programming, providing extra design options, BIM management. If they want you to go out and do drawings of the existing site conditions, that's a supplemental service. Civil engineering, landscape architecture, interior design. Part of the basic services is basic cost estimating. If they want detailed cost estimating, that's a supplemental service. As-built drawings, which are when you go out and you draw the project after it's built, because things can always change a little bit when they're actually being constructed. So if they want those drawings of the as-built conditions, that's a supplemental service. Post-occupancy evaluations, security systems. If they want the project to be fast-tracked, that's a supplemental service. If they want you to help with the furniture sourcing, that's a supplemental service. Historic preservation issues, building commissioning, or in general, anything beyond the basic structural, mechanical, and electrical. You'll see in the contract, it'll have a list of all the supplemental services I just said, and then it'll say, is this the responsibility of the architect or owner? And so for after each item, you'll pick a party or say, not applicable. If the owner wants to create a sustainable building beyond the basic considerations, E204 is the Sustainable Projects Exhibit. And that is the form you use, and the sustainability services will be considered a supplemental service. And then we have additional services. So additional services are services added after the agreement is signed. And an additional service is anything that changes the project scope. This could be changing the project size, quality, complexity, changing the project schedule, the budget, the procurement method, or the delivery method. If you design and develop a project and the codes change and you have to modify your drawings or specs, that is considered an additional service because you couldn't have known what was going to happen when the codes changed. If the owner, owner's consultants, or owner's contractors delay you, that's considered an additional service, because you have to pay for that extra time that you weren't prepared to be working on this project. If the owner wants you to attend any public hearings or meetings related to the project, those are additional services. And during procurement, you're going to help the owner with the contractor selection, but if they want you to actually review the contractor's qualifications, that's an additional service. In the contract, it's going to specify the number of submittal reviews, site visits, and the number of inspections the architect may be required to make for the substantial and final completion. Any number over those pre-established numbers would be considered an additional service. When the project reaches substantial completion, it should be able to be finished and reach final completion within 60 days. If it takes longer than that to reach final completion, that extra time that the architect works on it is going to be considered an additional service. And there are some other things in here. Again, look at this contract, get to know these things. In general, with an additional service, you submit a form to the owner saying, this is an additional service, sign this and I'll do it. There are a few things that the architect can just do without approval from the owner for the additional service. And that includes if the contractor provides the architect with a submittal out of sequence from the submittal schedule, that's an additional service that the architect can just do without approval from the owner, because if the contractor is doing that, it's probably something timely that they need to get ordered or get built. So that's probably why the contractor would be issuing that submittal before they were supposed to, because they realized like, oh, we got to do this now. And if the architect had to wait for the owner's approval to review that submittal, it would just delay the project. So the architect is allowed to review submittals out of sequence and then bill the owner for an additional service. If the contractor submits an RFI asking for information that they could have found by just looking within the contract documents, if that information is readily available and they were just too lazy to look for it, that's an additional service that the architect can complete without asking for the owner's approval. If there are over 4 claims on a project or an amount specified in the contract, that is an additional service. Section 5, the owner's responsibilities. So the owner is responsible for providing all the information relating to the project, including the project's requirements, the limitations, the project program, unless they have the architect do that as a supplemental service. And they are responsible for providing their objectives, their schedule, their constraints, and their requirements in a timely manner. They are responsible for giving the architect the budget for their project. And if they change the budget, they need to tell the architect. So this one I found really interesting because I worked on a project for a big client, and they never gave us a budget. And it wasn't my firm. I don't have a firm, so it wasn't my firm. But we kept working, and we were designing this like really elaborate place because the client was like, oh, I want that. But we had no budget. And it was always really weird to, you know, like, how do you design without a budget? You know, these people weren't like crazy rich. I mean, they had money, but like we knew that they weren't going to be spending it all on this project. And then so, yeah, we were working. I think we were like midway through the construction documents when they finally gave us a budget. And then the contractor had already been selected, and the contractor gave a cost estimate for our project based on where we were at. And it was $10 million over budget. It ended up becoming a huge ordeal, as you can imagine, because we're halfway through the CDs and we're $10 million over budget, which is really hard to remedy. That's a lot of money. The total budget was $30 million, and we were $10 million over budget. So getting rid of $10 million, you know, getting rid of a quarter of the project, it was crazy. We kept working and got the CDs done, but it became this huge issue with my employer and the client. Who covers the cost for those changes? And I don't know for certain, but what I would do is I would reference this section of the agreement that said the owner was supposed to give the budget for the project. It was one of their responsibilities that they failed to do. I don't know how that would really hold up in court, but that's where I would start with that. It was their obligation and they didn't meet that. Okay, sorry. So back to the owner's responsibilities. They are responsible for making decisions and approving the architect's submittals in a timely manner. They're responsible for the site surveys, geotechnical tests, coordinating their own consultants, all tests and inspections. By no means is the owner responsible for double-checking the architect's work. They're not responsible for going through it, trying to find mistakes. But if they find out about any mistakes, either through their own review or from one of their consultants, they are responsible for telling the architect. The owner is responsible for making sure that the architect has access to the job site before and during construction. Section 6, cost of work. The cost of work includes all of the costs required to build the project. It excludes the design fees and the cost for acquiring the land. The cost of work includes the contractor's overhead and profit and the value of materials and labor furnished by the owner. When the architect develops a cost estimate, it's only a cost estimate to their best judgment as a design professional. They are not professional cost estimators, so they cannot guarantee that it'll match the price that the contractors will give. But still, they are responsible for providing a pretty solid cost estimate. You can't just say, oh, I didn't know, that's not my job. No, it's actually your job. As an architect, it is your job to provide a cost estimate, but you are not expected to be as good as someone who does this for a living. The procurement phase must begin 90 days after the architect provides the owner with the construction documents. If the procurement phase happens more than 90 days after the CDs are finished, the architect's cost estimate is no longer valid because, as we know, the cost of materials and labor changes all the time. So if it's more than 3 months after the CDs have been finished, who knows what the costs are going to do? And the architect cannot be liable for their cost estimate being wrong when it's been so long after they finished. So within 90 days of the architect finishing the construction documents, if the owner puts it out to bid and receives the bids and they're over budget, the owner has 5 options. 1, they can increase the budget. 2, they can try to negotiate with the contractors or rebid the project. 3, they can terminate the agreement with the architect. 4, they can have the architect revise the drawings to meet the project's budget. And if they do this, the architect has to revise those drawings without requesting an additional fee. 5, the owner can select alternatives to reduce the project cost. Section 7, copyrights and licenses. The architect owns the copyright for their instruments of services. So all of the architect's drawings and specs, they own the copyright for that material. And the architect's consultants own their own copyrights for their own work. When the owner uses the architect's instrument of service, the architect is granting them a non-exclusive license for their instruments of service. The owner cannot use those documents to develop another project, even if the project is located on the same site, without approval from the architect. If the owner ends the agreement with the architect or the architect's consultants before the construction is complete, but the owner continues to use the instruments of service to build the project, the architect and those consultants are not liable for their use. Section 8, claims and disputes. So when there is a conflict between two parties, the owner-contractor or the owner-architect, any disputes first need to try to be resolved through mediation. Mediation is when you have a third party come in and try to help you guys work it out. They tell you based on what they've heard, what they recommend you do. And the parties are responsible for going to a mediator first, and they will all share the cost of mediation. If they don't like the results of mediation, they will choose to either go to arbitration or litigation. Arbitration is cheaper, faster, and binding. Litigation is very expensive, time-consuming, but you can have the decisions appealed. So litigation is court, arbitration is like mediation, but with a binding decision. Section 9, termination or suspension. If the owner doesn't pay the architect is allowed to terminate or suspend the agreement. If the architect suspends the agreement, they must first provide 7 days' notice. If the owner wishes to resume the agreement, they must first pay the architect all the money owed. The owner is allowed to suspend the agreement, but they must first pay the architect for all the services rendered to that point. If the owner suspends the agreement for more than 90 days, for reasons that the architect is not responsible for, the architect may terminate the agreement. If either party wants to terminate the agreement, they must first provide the other party with 7 days' notice. The owner is allowed to terminate the agreement for any reason at their convenience. The architect is allowed to only terminate the agreement if they don't get paid or if the agreement has been suspended for 90 days. Section 10, miscellaneous provisions. The owner and architect's representatives are also bound by this agreement. The architect is not responsible for hazardous materials unless they specified them in their drawings. This section says that the architect is allowed to photograph the project for their own marketing purposes, but they cannot share any of the photos that contain the owner's proprietary information. The owner shall credit the architect for the project when they use it in their own promotional material. Both the architect and the owner have to respect the other's proprietary information and not share it with other parties unless they're ordered to do so by the law in which case they need to notify the other party within 7 days' notice. Section 11, compensation. The architect's compensation can be a stipulated sum, which is a fixed amount of money, a percent basis, which is a percent of the total cost of the project, or other, which will be specified in this agreement. And then the supplemental and additional services may be calculated differently, and the amount of those compensations will be provided in the agreement. The architect is reimbursed for their consultant fees at a markup, which is typically 10% to cover the costs that the architect incurs for coordination. So when the architect hires the engineer and the landscape architect and the interior designer, all of those parties work under the architect, and they have to coordinate all of their drawings and communicate between the owner's needs to the consultants. And it's not as simple as just outsourcing the work. They still have to manage the consultants. So they are allowed to, and not just allowed, they should mark up what the consultants are charging them. And typically they'll mark it up 10% to cover their costs for coordinating all of them. This section of the contract will also provide the hourly rate for the architect and all the architect's employees and consultants, just in case anything happens, like an additional service happens that is at an hourly rate. Those hourly rates are outlined right there, so there's no confusion about what those are. Those are set ahead of time. Qualifying reimbursable expenses include any expenses for long-distance travel related to the project, permitting fees, printing costs, postage, renderings and physical models that the owner requested. If the architect just starts making renderings or making models to do studies, but the owner didn't ask for them, that is not a reimbursable expense. It's only if the owner specifically asks for those things that it's a reimbursable expense. If the owner requests that the architect carry a higher insurance policy than they normally do, the cost difference will be paid for by the owner. Progress payments shall be made to the architect monthly. If they are late, they will accrue an interest rate set forth in this contract. And the owner cannot withhold payments from the architect unless they already went to court and the architect was liable for some project-related damages. Then that would be the only time that the owner is allowed to withhold money. Until it's settled in a legal proceeding, the owner is not allowed to withhold payments from the architect. And then the owner and architect sign it, and it goes into effect. All right. So, wow, we did it, guys. Review all these episodes, especially these three on the contracts. These are going to be really, really important for your test. If you want to check out my study guide, arestudyguidepodcast.com has an outline of all the contracts with all the information you need to know, as well as all of the other stuff related to construction and evaluation. The study guide's a great resource. Building Construction Illustrated by Francis Ching is like one of the greatest books ever for us. So definitely review that. Also, I would review Building Code Illustrated, also Francis Ching. Brush up on your building code, your ADA code, your envelope details. I think those are the big ones. Definitely always look at the ARE 5.0 handbook. Check out the section that's devoted to construction and evaluation and see what they specifically tell you is going to be covered on the test. They are not going to have anything on your test that they don't tell you is going to be on there. So there are no surprises. Review the handbook. If there's any area that you're not feeling too sharp in, look at the reference matrix in the back and see what books might help you. Okay. So. That's it. I will see you on the other side. Until then, I hope you have a great, great time studying for this test. Enjoy the sunshine wherever you're at. Wishing you all the best. Good luck.